number 2012-5001, NCLN 20, Incorporated against the United States. Mr. Ellis, when you're ready.
May I please support Attorney George Ellis for NCLN 20. I would also like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Very well.
Okay. We have here, case where a contractor, a small business contractor, in a very difficult time in our nation's history, was attempting to perform on a security guard contract in the state of Michigan. And ultimately, that contractor was terminated, for default. We feel that the lower court erred profoundly for a number of reasons. First of all,
Mr. Ellis, one of the things that disturbs me is on page 56 of the opening brief, NCLN 20 says that Mr. Pinot, quote, perjured himself, close quote, and you have that in boldface and underline both.
Yes.
When he explained why he reviewed some of the contract materials.
Mm-hmm.
What's the support in the record?
That's
a serious accusation.
It is. The support in the record is that Mr. Pinot actually stated that it was a part of his normal process to review contracts as like this. However, we also have in the records that the contracting officer, Mr. Dobbs, said specifically that he had sent a memo to Mr. Pinot instructing him to actually review this contract and take a look at this contract. And so what we're saying is that at a minimum, that is an accurate reflection of how this review came about, and that he wasn't necessarily just doing this review as a part of his normal course of business, but in fact he was instructed by the contracting officer, by his superiors, to undertake this review.
Why couldn't they both be right, and why is that proof of perjury?
Well, could they both be right? We feel
sure.
Is it theoretically possible that they were both right? Sure. We feel that Mr. Pinot certainly knew, especially given the context of what was going on at that time. 9/11 just happened, and they had some concerns at that time already about this contractor. And we believe that if this was this was done over the weekend, September 15th, 16th, that was a weekend when it was done. So we find it not quite credible that he wouldn't recall that he was in fact instructed to take a look at this. There was a memo that was sent to him, an email, that said take a look at this contractor. And in fact, he subsequently put together a memo that talked about contract deficiencies. And he was also asked specifically to take a look at whether or not this award was properly made. And so all of that suggests to us that he can't then say in subsequent testimony that, oh no, I just did this as a result of my normal review. We don't believe that this was a part of the normal review, and we believe he knew that this wasn't a part of his normal review. What we feel that the lower court erred for several reasons. One, I think in a global perspective, the lower court failed to look at all of these actions in context. This is a contract which was awarded pursuant to the Small Business Administration, 8A Administration Services. And what that means is the whole idea is these are small, socially disadvantaged businesses. One of the key components to this contract was the MOU pursuant to which it was granted. And that required that if there was any decision to or action to terminate the contract, that the SBA would be involved. And part of that is to help and assist these small contractors, these small businesses. And we feel that that the failure of notice, the lower court, when considering the impact of the failure of notice, quite frankly, very conclusorily says, finds there's no prejudice. lower court doesn't even look at the question of whether failure to notice in the overall context amounted to bad faith. And we would say that it did. The fact that there were, the IG's report's really, really clear and we think is very powerful with respect to the options that the GSA had, with respect to the disparate treatment. And although certainly they gave explanations for the disparate treatment, which were accepted by the lower court, we feel again that the lower court just failed to put these things in context. This goes back to the bad faith, and we absolutely believe that there is a consistent pattern of bad faith. It goes back to the original MID.
I read with interest the Inspector General's report, and with respect to the disparate treatment, what was that?
Well, you've got the disparate treatment arises from, and we would go even a little further than the Inspector General's report goes. So with respect to the IG report, the disparate treatment was you had a four-state contractor, GSSC, which is effectively, basically, around shortly after 9/11, it's clear to the GSA that their contractors are having problems getting gun permits. That's not a surprise. And so they actually communicate with their four-state contractor that there may be, we understand that you, for new posts, you may not be able to procure all of the weapons permits necessary, all the weapons necessary, and then in fact, all of your guards, especially at new locations, may not conform to GSA Guard 2 requirements. And we also, of course, mentioned the Ohio contractor, which was allowed a longer period of time in which to get
the record. The record also shows, and this, you know, I'm interested in what you're saying.
Sure.
But the record seems to show that your client kept telling the GSA, "We'll be able to do this. We'll be able to do this on time."
Yes. If I can, let me step back a little bit, because I think that's the flaw of that where we're going now. I feel it's a part of the flaw of the lower court's analysis. If you get too far in the weeds and ask the question, was any particular decision reasonable? Was any particular decision motivated by bad faith? And let's see if we can find that bad faith in any particular decision. You won't necessarily find it. And so to us, what the really is when you bubble up a bit and look at the entire administration of this contract, this is where you actually see, it's like going at a impressionist piece of art and standing 2 inches away. Well, you don't see what's going until you step back. And so, is it fair to say that the GSA had reasonable concerns about this contractor's ability to perform? Certainly. But there are many avenues to which they could have availed themselves. Things like notice to the SBA so that the SBA could intervene. Things like extending the incumbent contractor. Now sure, they gave an explanation for why they didn't extend the incumbent contractor because they said they'd had an experience in the past. But we have uncontroverted testimony, even from Mr. McKay, which says Mr. McKay was of course the contracting manager for USI and the contracting manager for NCLN 20. We have uncontroverted testimony where he says, yeah, he believed that it would have taken only another week to get the required gun permit. So we're not looking at a long time. And it seems crystal clear, again, from the beginning, from the prosecution or the response to the MIB. The response to the MIB was then and continues to misrepresent and misunderstand the FAR regulations. The IG's report, as you read, basically laid waste to their claims with respect to the FAR regulations. They applied the wrong FAR regulation. They read it wrong, quite frankly, the one that they did apply, and they didn't apply the one that they should have applied, which would require them to see if, by clear and convincing evidence, there was a justified mistaken bid here. They didn't do that, and they didn't do that because they acted like the gorilla in the cage. They basically swatted this small contractor, said, Not only did they say your MIB is not clear in its face, but they said, by the way, if you don't verify that bid, you face losing your bid. You face losing this contract. And that kind of response, first of all, is not anticipated by the FAR regulations. Why would there be FAR regulations about a mistaken bid? Why would there be FAR regulations which say, hey, there may be problems in a bid these bids are huge, which couldn't have been foreseen, which are inadvertent. There's a process for that. They didn't care about the process for that.
When the termination was changed from a default to convenience, do you have any argument as to whether that plays into or the bad faith?
Absolutely, absolutely. We feel very strongly, first of all, the termination, the change to the convenience, let's be honest, the change to the convenience comes after they get a report from the DCAA, which says, well, basically, you're only looking at being on the hook for about $47,000 of startup costs. Well, once you say that, well, the what we're on the hook for isn't that big, sure, we'll change it. That's A. It comes six years after the original T4D. But what's also very important that the lower court never considers, the lower court looks at the T4D and says the T4D was unlawful.
What's that, the termination?
The termination for default. And then the lower court moves on and says, hey, but this is now a termination for convenience, so let's look at termination for convenience. What the lower court never does is ask the question, was the original T4D motivated by bad faith? Because if the original T4D was motivated by bad faith, then the question is, does that bad faith somehow go away when it's 6 years later morphed into a termination for convenience because they just found out that it's only going to cost them $47,000? Our answer is no. That bad faith from the original T4D, and there's bad faith all over that, flows through to the T4C, and the lower court never considered that. So the two pieces of evidence, first of all, that the lower court never considered when looking at the question of bad faith, the lower court looked at the issue of the notice to the SBA under the court's termination for default analysis. Well, wait, but when the court goes to termination for convenience analysis, the court doesn't look at the failure to notify the SBA and whether that says anything about bad faith.
Do you have any legal authority or something to support the argument that the change from the termination for default to termination for convenience would constitute bad faith?
No. A, no, we don't. But we certainly feel that. So my argument here, our argument is not that a termination for default is somehow by definition bad faith. Clearly, that can't be our argument, right? So what we're saying is, however, that in doing the bad faith analysis that was later done as looking at the termination for convenience, we're saying that absolutely. It is reasonable and should have been asked whether or not there was bad faith involved in the original termination for default. And the question is whether or not that bad faith, if it's there, and we believe it is, because quite frankly, as the court says, termination for default was an extreme measure. Okay, it really was, and most importantly, it was going to sock $1.6 million of re-procurement costs on this small contractor. And this was not necessary, and they did it in the last minute, and they gave no notice to the SBA. When the SBA tried to intervene, as you would have seen from the IT report, they basically told her, put it in writing. These people were bullies from the beginning. They had no good faith with respect to this contractor, and only when you bubble out and don't look at everything in silos, but look at the entire pattern of conduct, is it crystal clear, we believe, it's replete with bad faith.
Mr. Ellis, you're into your rebuttal time. Would you like
yes.
to say that?
Very good, please. Thank
Very
you.
Good. Mr. Mickle.
Mr. Ellis, may it please the court. The trial court properly determined that GSA's termination in this case was performed appropriately. Now, were there mistakes made? We've already admitted that they were. They didn't provide the cure notice as required by the contract. However, they didn't provide the cure notice at that time because you have to go back and put yourself in the shoes of the contracting officer. It's easy to second guess and say that they were treated different, people were treated differently and things like that, but 3 weeks after the attack of 9/11, 1 week after a federal marshal was murdered in a federal building and the carnage was only stopped because someone was able to return fire, the contracting officer on Friday evening, September 29th, was faced with the decision. Do I go home tonight hoping that NCL120 will be able to perform on Monday, October 1st, or do I terminate this contract for default because I've requested assurances?
Could you extend the USI contract?
Mr. Dobbs and Mr. Pernow said, yes, Your Honor, they could have extended it pursuant to the terms of the contract. They did not in this case for several reasons. One is USI had specifically told the contracting officer that they would not perform unless it was a long-term extension. Once again, you have to remember the circumstances. This was right after 9/11 when security guard firms who had licenses and permits, and more importantly, weapons and ammo, were at a premium. And they had to make sure that they could keep their workers.
Some of the events described in the Inspector General report happened before September 20th when the officer was shot. And so, let me ask you, under what circumstances does the GSA decide to change a termination for default to termination for convenience?
Well, I would have hypothetical. In this case, they did it because 5 years, well, in this case, though, the standard for termination for convenience has to be in the interest of the government. And in this case, they determined that after NCLN 20 submitted a certified claim several years after the fact and provided evidence that, in fact, they had started some work towards performing upon the contract. Because you have to remember, as Mr. Dobbs testified, it wasn't until the DCA audit came in that the government was put on notice that, in fact, NCLN 20 had done anything. Because at the time of the termination, Mr. Dobbs had this information in his head. He had, I got a request for insurance.
What are the conditions that, what's the criteria that GSA uses to change a termination for default to termination for convenience?
Well, I don't know if there's any set criteria, Your Honor. I think it's all fact-based, and they have to look at the circumstances and determine if it's in the best interest.
Well, one would certainly be, and it would presumably be the one that would apply here, I would think, is if the T4D is just not going to stand up.
Well, I think that was in the back of their mind.
It was pretty much in the front of their mind, as far as I could see. I mean, that was the reason, wasn't it? Just frankly, between us here.
I think Mr. Dobbs said he was looking at a lot of things. I think Mr. Dobbs was very concerned here and thought that maybe the T4D, but he also did know that, yes, now that I have an IG report that was written after the fact and said, you know what, you should have given that cure notice. And you know what, a year after the fact, maybe I could have extended if I'd only known that, you know, if NCLN 20 had came forward and said, give us 2 months, that's all we need.
The IG reported on issues that seemed to me to be standard methods of operation for the GSA, like submitting notice to the SBA. Isn't that a requirement under all Section 8 contracts?
All Section 8 contracts.
Prior to termination, that there's notice submitted to the SBA?
Well, prior to termination, pursuant to the FAR clause for SBA, it is. However, when the default clause FAR...
It's in the FAR, and it didn't happen here at all.
It didn't happen until after the fact, and Mr. Dobbs testified that the reason he didn't do it because it was at the end of the day Friday when he terminated. He did notify the SBA first thing that Monday morning to say that, that they were going to do a termination, and they were going to give a contract to another 8A contractor, USI. And as I said, that's an important point. It wasn't that, you know, there was no intent, specific intent, bad faith to injure NCLN 20. In fact, the record shows that on September 12th, right after 9/11, the assistant contracting officer actually wrote NCLN 20 and said, please, if you need any help, let us know. If you're having trouble getting your licenses or dealing with the state agencies, please contact us. But in the end, the contracting officer in this case had valid reasons for being concerned that performance wouldn't begin, and maybe in hindsight he did convert to T4C, said maybe that's what he should have done in the first place, but in no way does the record indicate that this was in some type of bad faith or animus. And the trial court went out of its way to ensure that NCLN 20 had time to present its case to the trial court for it to determine. The trial court not only had a trial, it also did the rare occurrence where it actually traveled to Chicago to attend depositions so he could view the credibility of the government's witnesses. And after all that effort, the trial court heard their case and just determined that there's not bad faith here.
Now, my understanding of termination for convenience law is that this is an animal that's effectively unique to the government. It's a privilege that the government has to unburden itself from contractual obligations that otherwise would result in anticipatory repudiation and breach damages, but that the limitation is really the only limitation, effectually, at least the only one that seems to be applicable here, is this bad faith notion.
We agree.
Bad faith, then it gets converted in effect to an absolute breach on the part of the government, which results in all profits that would have been earned from the contract. But what I was puzzled by and couldn't really get a sufficiently clear notion from the case law in this area is what exactly is understood by bad faith in this setting. And bad faith is one of those terms that gets a different meaning depending on its setting. What is it your understanding of what the thrust of the case law is as to what is meant by that term as applied in the setting?
Well, it appears, one is, you're right, the termination for convenience clause is a creature of a sovereign. That's absolutely true. Second, from reading the case law on bad faith, as you go from the history of Torricello, and actually it's summed up well in Krasgowski, it's kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
But really, looking at bad faith here, I think what you'd have to show is that the contractor, and because it'd be a breach of contract, the contracting officer or the government actually entered into the contract knowing it wasn't going to perform. And that's not the case here, because in this case, we wanted to perform. We would have loved to have NCLN 20 perform, but they just didn't tell us could they or would they. And that's all we wanted to have, so that's why we terminated, because Mr. Dobbs' primary mission was to make sure on 1 October there was armed security guards in those federal buildings. And that's why he took that action. But in this case, the record doesn't indicate that there would be bad faith where the contracting officer actually somehow said, we're going to enter into a contract knowing full well that there was evidence out there that knows that NCLN 20...
Is there case law that stands for that proposition?
Pardon me, sir, Your Honor?
Is there case law that supports that?
Well, I think the case law that I would look to was, like, for instance, Krasgowski talks about that, where it talks about a fraud in the inducement. Now, that was probably dictated in Krasgowski, I think, but those are the two instances when there would be...
What about if the bad faith forms or gels a week after the contract is entered into? What if the intent to breach or to not fulfill the contract by the government is formed a week after?
Well, there was some type of conspiracy on the part where they actually said, we're going to have specific intent to injure, or like the traditional bad faith that's described, like in the cases of the AMPRO or something, where there's a specific intent to injure the party.
No, the bad faith you described, where the party intends that the contract not be fulfilled.
Well, then I think the case law then also supports the idea that if you're going to do a termination, one, it has to be in the best interest. And some case laws talk about the fact that there has to be some type of desire to preserve the competition that's set forth in CECA, the Competition and Contracting Act. Like you have to, there has to be. They use the term change in circumstances in some cases. For instance, we found a better price or something, but that goes to why that's proper for the T4C. Maybe if there was not a change in circumstances, we just decided that we were going to terminate. But even the recent case law seems to support that the government can do that as long as there's a proper basis for it.
Well, that's the whole question, what constitutes proper basis. I mean, once you say that if there is a proper basis, you can pretty much note that most everything is okay because you've just called it proper. To give you a concrete example, I mean, suppose that after the contract is awarded, the contracting officer, who's an avid Chicago Bears fan, discovers that the head of the contractor is a Green Bay fan. He decides, no, we're getting rid of him. That would be bad faith, clearly, right?
There would be no government interest in ensuring that a Green Bay,
right,
despite
we
being a Packer fan myself,
right,
that would be not a proper termination. But we have to remember that there's a presumption that the government officials are not going to go out and do something like that. And moreover, in this case, why it counsels against any bad faith is because there was a legal review. There was consult with their supervisors. You'd have to have a tremendous conspiracy, at least under these facts, to show that in fact that NCLN 20, that the government was conspiring to ensure that NCLN 20 wouldn't get this contract. Because the bottom line is any time there's a termination, if there's four improper bases for the termination, but one proper basis, then the proper basis still stands and the government is entitled to terminate that contract. But in this case, I think the record overall shows that the primary...
That's true for termination of default. Is it true for termination under convenience, for convenience?
I don't know if the case... I'm not aware that the case law would discriminate that way.
Okay.
I mean, the case law is pretty well settled from College Boat on that if there's another basis for terminating, I don't know why it would not carry forward. But the termination for convenience clause does have some steps in there that the contracting officer has to do. And in this case, one of the problems the contracting office did was usually you'd have that cure notice where there could at least be a dialogue with the contractor. But the problem in this case is was it just wasn't practicable to give that cure notice, because if they gave that cure notice on 1 October, there was no guarantee there was going to be guards in those federal facilities.
Mr. Mickel, Mr. Ellis makes an argument that that there was perjury on the part of Mr. Pinot. I want you to address that, please, because it's criminal conduct, and I take it very seriously.
Well, one is we'd agree with your honors. There was no perjury, and we must remember too is Mr. Pinot was the one witness the trial court actually attended his deposition and actually questioned Mr. Pinot and sat right next to him and stared at him throughout the whole deposition. So if there was any evidence of some type of perjury or any animus, you would think that the trial court, with her experience, would be able to determine that. And that was not found. And moreover, those statements weren't inconsistent. Mr. Pinot said, I am going to review the contract, and that's what I did. The fact that Art Dobbs sent him a memo and said, please review that, that's not inconsistent. And in fact, Mr. Pinot's supervisor specifically testified as one of the reasons why he got a bad efficiency report one time was he did too much review. He spent 45 days reviewing a contract instead of maybe doing some other type of action. But there was no animus. He was just a fastidious contracting officer. So I know I have a few more minutes, but unless the court has any other questions, we hope that the judgment of the trial court is affirmed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Ellis, you have a couple of minutes of rebuttal if you want to use them.
Thank you. The counsel for the GSA said something very interesting, and that was that if there is a proper basis for convenience, then that vitiates bad faith. We actually think that's one of the mistakes that was made underneath, is we actually believe both of those can coexist simultaneously, that we fully concede that there were things going on with respect to 9/11 that reasonably made them worry. We're not going to say that there weren't, but there were options. And so the question isn't ultimately simply was NCLN 20 going to perform. The question is also, but what action did the GSA take? They took an action which was extraordinarily punitive, and it was not necessary. They could have actually terminated for convenience at any time. They could have terminated for convenience at any time. But instead they waited until a couple of days before performance was due to terminate for default. Please?
They were asked.
They weren't asked to wait in order to terminate the contract. They were asked to accommodate.
Your client a chance to perform.
Absolutely. They were asked, but there's a very big difference between give us a chance to perform and wait until the last minute and give us one day notice that you're going to terminate us for default. I think those are very, very different. And so, but my point here is that there were circumstances that were happening, but they had options. They had options with respect to extending. They had options they had been making accommodations for their other contractors at the time. They could have, on September 14th, on September 16th, they could have done a termination for convenience. Why didn't they do it?
Let me see if I understand. Are you saying that if they had initially terminated for convenience as opposed to terminating for default, then this case would go away?
No. What I'm saying is that the decision of which termination to choose.
You find that the fact that they chose termination for default to be probative on the bad faith issue.
It is probative. Absolutely.
But you're not suggesting that had they gone immediately.
That's right. I'm not suggesting the opposite.
Right, that's fine.
But I am suggesting that it's probative, and what is clear from the record below is that the trial court never considered this. The trial court simply didn't look at this context. And then, again, when you put it in line with all the other evidence, how they handled the MIB, their misreading of the, quite frankly, their bullying behavior with respect to the MIB, their failure to give notice to the SBA, which was necessary under the MOU, so that the SBA could intervene and try and make this contract still work. That's the purpose there. And when they short-circuited that process by telling appellant at the last possible minute, oh, by the way, you have 24 hours, they basically knowingly left these people no ability whatsoever to cure. And that is what we are saying is absolute evidence of bad faith. And for that reason, we would ask you to reverse the lower court and remand it for damages, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank both counsel. The case is submitted.